Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and authors who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. Our sponsor for the first season is Park Road Books, the oldest and only full-service independent bookstore in Charlotte. They're located in Park Road Shopping Center. They've got a great staff and an awesome collection of books. And if they don't have something in stock that you want, they can order it for you and have it there quickly. And please check out our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. You can get information about the show and about our guest authors. We'd love to have you become a regular listener. You can listen on iTunes or wherever you like to get your podcasts. And on our website, you can sign up for our email list. We promise not to spam you, just give you updates from time to time about the show. And if you do join, as a thank you, we'll give you a free ebook, the first in a trilogy written by your host. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. Today we're going to hear readings from Charlotte area author Paul Grzeha. We'll hear a short story called Desiree, about a man struggling with addiction. We'll hear Sonnet to Tinder, a humorous take on that love app. We'll hear excerpts from Beach Subsidy. It's a story about a beach reclamation project subsidized by the government in a place full of people who happen not to support the idea of handouts. We'll hear a poem called Babel's Soldier about how monuments to the past can create division among people. And then finally, we'll hear Juxtapose. It's a recent flash fiction piece in the spirit of a lyric essay. It examines the emotional and experiential differentials between a father and son that exemplify that of many generations.
Desiree. I wake up face down, tangled in sheets, my head and one arm hanging from the bed. My hand, asleep and numb, somehow holds an empty scotch glass. I do not look around, but can feel she is gone. I met Desiree last night in a damp, barren church basement at my AA meeting. She sat next to me on a plastic lawn chair in the group circle, head bent forward with long black hair hanging down both sides of her face, such that only the gaze of her dark blue eyes could be seen. At times it looked as if she were peering at me from the deep recesses of a cave. It was sharing time, and the group leader went around the circle for news of or confessions until he reached me. I had not slipped in over a year, and therefore had no confessions. Instead, I talked about how difficult it is to find friends, date, or even any semblance of a social life when it all revolves around a drink. Desiree watched me from her cave as I spoke. The group leader skipped Desiree, maybe because she was new, partly to help, and partly out of curiosity. I leaned toward her and whispered, "If this is your first meeting and you want to tell them about yourself, just speak up." "I'm not here for myself," she said, her voice slightly raspy, as if she had not spoken in a while. "I'm here for someone else." She stared at me for a moment, then looked away. I nodded. That's how I first started coming. In my case, the someone else I came for was the judge who had ordered it. After the meeting, as I opened the church door, I saw Desiree outside, leaning on a white column, looking toward the distant city lights. She was outlined by the city's glow. The silhouette of her thin body and untamed hair made her look feral and erotic. I watched her for a while, then slipped out the door behind her and headed toward my car. I was surprised to find her fallen step beside me, her head bent forward, hands clasped before her body, as if leaving Mass instead of AA. After a few silent steps, I said, "The first meeting is awkward. You're not sure what to say." She looked toward me, her features still veiled. "I never said it was my first meeting. I've been to many meetings." "I thought you said you were here for someone else. Do you go to a lot of AA meetings for others?" She raised her head and stood up straight. The hair fell back from her face like a curtain drawn open, revealing a sly smile upon a clear, pale complexion. "All the time." "That's an odd hobby." "I have a lot of them," she responded. She was more attractive than I expected. Now that I could see her face, she did not appear as foreboding as she had at the meeting or as wild as she had moments earlier. She somehow even seemed familiar. "In fact," she said, "one of them is eating, and I'm starving." She looked up and down. "If you take me to dinner, you can tell me more about AA, and maybe I will show you some of my other hobbies." Hoping to impress, I took her to the Brown Derby. We rode in my less than impressive worn-down BMW, left over from better days. As we rattled along, she retreated into her silence, periodically giving me an anxious glance, as if she was hungry and I was not driving fast enough. This unnerved me. I filled the void by rambling on about my past life as a lawyer and how a series of DWIs and drunken arrests had ended it. Now I work at Kinko's, making copies for the law firms I used to work for, I told her with an ironic grin. That's a familiar story, she said flatly. The restaurant was warm and woody, decorated like a 1940s dinner club, with caricatures of period celebrities covering almost every inch of the walls. The patrons wore sport coats or carried logo-emblazoned purses. I had not been to an expensive restaurant in years and felt out of place in my worn jeans and scruffy Kinko's golf shirt. The maitre d' sat us at a small table near the bar. Above the table hovered a cartoonish drawing of W.C. Fields, whose nose, bulbous and red, as he raised his silver-pink flask to his lips. Desiree sat across from me, silently playing with a small red votive that burned between us on the table. I ordered an appetizer, and soon the sweet, spicy smell of fried calamari enveloped us. Between bites, Desiree picked up a menu from the table and opened it. "I think I'll have a glass of wine with dinner," she said, peering at me over the top of the leather-bound menu, beckoning me to join her. "Are you sure you've been to a lot of meetings?" I asked her with a laugh. "If so, you seem to be missing a key point." She raised her head and sat up. The sly smile reemerged. "What's the point of having a good meal without a nice glass of wine to go with it? Besides, wine is one of my hobbies." "Probably not the best hobby for you," I said. She ignored my comment and insisted I call the waiter over. When I protested, she leaned across the table and gently touched my hand, her warmth traveling up my arm. How long had it been since anyone had touched me? "Just one glass, I promise. No harm," she said. When the wine arrived, we sipped it while finishing the calamari, each taste of the Pinot Grigio filling my mouth with a light flavor of minerals, while its dryness left me thirsty for more. Over a year had passed since I had allowed wine to wash across my tongue, and, like a touch, I had almost forgotten how warm and filling it was. Desiree smiled as she ate and drank, her skin losing some of its paleness, her eyes losing some of their edge. She leaned back in her chair, spread her arms, and stretched, like a cat awakening. Although she was thin, I'd begin to notice she had shape, and my eyes lingered where her breast pressed against her black blouse. "So you were a lawyer," she said as she finished her stretch. "Tell me more. Wife? Kids?" "The marriage license left soon after the law license. Maybe Maria got tired of picking me up at the police station." I took another sip. "Never got around to having kids. Probably just as well. I skipped the details of my early efforts to sober up and win Maria back. But something I wanted to linger on tonight." Our glasses were empty. Desiree picked out a Sauvignon Blanc from the wine list. I gave her a disapproving stare. "We need something to drink with our meal," she said, with a dismissive wave of her hand. The bottle arrived with the salad. As dinner continued and the bottle emptied, Desiree came to life. She knew all about wines, which Beaujolais went with pork, why Bordeaux is best with lamb, and the correct Rioja for spiced goat. When I attempted to order a cab for our second bottle, she laughed and had me order Burgundy instead. "As an alcoholic ex-lawyer, you should know a lot more about wines," she teased. I began to absorb her enthusiasm and feel the warmth of her company. "You know, if I stay out of trouble for a few years, I might be able to reinstate my law license," I said, sitting back in my chair, swirling my wine. "Couldn't exactly pick up where I left off as a partner, but I could start over and probably get things back together pretty quick." As I took a taste of the Burgundy, the optimism infused me further. "Maybe even afford to have a nice dinner more often. Would you bring me?" she asked, wiggling her shoulders and batting her eyes in mock flirtation. I grinned. "Of course, any time you want." After dinner on the way to the car, Desiree did a little rumba to the 1940s music piping from the restaurant. I watched her body sway and her hair, now pulled back behind her shoulders, flow across her back. She no longer seemed pale and thin, but flushed and healthy. In the car, I said, "I guess I should take you back to the church. I'm not ready to call it an evening yet. What about going back to your place for a nightcap first?" I laughed. "This may come as a surprise to you, but I don't have anything to drink at my house." "That's okay. There's a liquor store just down the street. If we head straight over, we can catch them before they close. I knew the liquor store was a bad idea, but I no longer had the will to resist. It seemed an unimaginably long time since a woman came to my apartment. When we walked into my small, empty kitchen, Desiree opened the bottle of Oban scotch we had purchased. She grabbed two dusty scotch bottles from the back of the cabinet and poured splashes of the caramel-colored liquor into each. She added ice, handed me one, and held up her own in a toast. "Here's to your starting over." She paused and looked at the glass, a smile touching her lips. "To our starting over." We raised our identical glasses up for a toast, clicked the mirror images together, then drained them in one swig. The liquor burned pleasantly, leaving the old familiar taste of peat moss and smoke that I so missed. Desiree refilled my glass, and I stepped from the kitchen to the living room. The rooms distinguished from one another only by the change from tile to carpet. I turned on the radio. A song played, singing of red, red wine. Desiree came over and wrapped her hands around me, the cold of the glass in her hand penetrating the back of my neck. She slowly resumed her rumba dance, rubbing against me, infecting me with the music and the motion. I pushed back her hair to see her more clearly. Her face was tanned with a warm glow. She moved closer, and our lips met. She tasted of minerals and smoky peat moss. I ran my hands over her body, her skin, cool, smooth, and sleek, like glass. She responded and took hold of me, took control of me. Later in the bedroom, I remember waking during the night to see Desiree standing naked by the bed, head leaning forward, her pale, thin body, hair obscuring her face, eyes staring out at me. Near her on the nightstand sat the partly empty bottle of Oban. I felt sick, and my head screamed through a thick haze. I sat up and mumbled, "Go to sleep." She leaned over the bed, handed me a glass with a few drops of scotch left, kissed me, then turned and walked away. I emptied the glass into my dry mouth and fell back. I heard someone retching when I passed out. I sit up in bed and the glass falls from my sleeping hand. Small, sharp pains shoot up and down my arm as it awakens. I almost enjoy the feeling because, like acupuncture, it distracts me from my larger pains in my body, my head. I look down at the Kinko shirt I still wear. Spots of dried vomit litter the front. The room sits empty and quiet. I shiver at the sight of the scotch bottle on the dresser. "She's gone," I croak. "Thank God." I stumble to the bathroom, wash myself. I look in the mirror, my blue eyes now red and sunk deep in swollen sockets. The lonely silence of the apartment presses in on me. My mind wanders to peat moss and minerals. I lower my head into my hands in despair. She'll be back. She always comes back.
Paul Kurzeha, an award-winning Charlotte author, is a corporate lawyer who writes well. Imagine that. He is obtaining his MA in creative writing at UNC Charlotte. He's a winner of the UNCC James McGarvin Award for Writing and a winner of the Elizabeth Simpson Smith Short Story Award. He was also a finalist for the Doris Betts Fiction Prize. Paul has most recently been published in Boston Accent Literary Magazine. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
What got you into writing?
So I guess I've been writing short stories for probably the past 4 or 5 years. I'd always had an interest in writing. And interestingly, as a lawyer, although we do use wherefores and hereofs, you write every day. And you learn to write clearly and well.
Yeah, but nobody wants to read what lawyers write.
But you don't write it creatively. So it is a very different skill set.
Exactly.
But it did allow and does allow lawyers to have an ability to shift over to fiction writing if they want to use their imagination and sort of change the way they write. And that's been the part of the big struggle, is to try to not to write like a lawyer.
Yeah, I tell all my friends that I've worked very hard to learn not to write like a lawyer. And it's difficult. Although some have said, my opponents over the years have said, this is a great transition for me because all my briefs have seemed like fiction to them. But you're a corporate lawyer. I mean, that's even worse, right? I mean, you look at these long contracts, and now you're shifting to...
Well, one of the interesting things about being a corporate lawyer is that much of what I do isn't writing contracts as much as explaining them in writing to non-lawyers, which forces you to write in a more simplified format and in a very clear way. And I've found that it's actually been helpful in fiction, in that I'm quite sure that most of my stories are pretty clear about what they're saying.
You seem to want to, in your stories, leave the reader with something to think about. Does that come from your analytical background?
I think so, to some extent. But often I'll write a story with a concept in mind that I want to bring out, as opposed to starting with a character. I start with an idea that I want to present, and then I develop characters and story around it.
You've got this penchant for education. I mean, you just never stop going back to school. Right? you went to undergrad, then you went to law school, then you got your CPA, and now you're back in school again.
Yeah, I can't explain it. A penchant for self-torture.
So Desiree could have been Eve, temptation from start to beginning to the end.
That is the idea behind the use of the name Desiree, is that she is that temptation to fall back to alcoholism.
I like this line, my marriage license left soon after the law license.
That's a very lawyerly line.
Yeah. But it's all about this fall from grace and trying to work through the problem, and yet this demon is haunting. And that's why when you said she's not there for herself, she's there for everybody in that room, right?
Yeah, and for him in particular, that temptation sitting there.
So where'd you get this idea? Was it a dark and stormy night?
You know, actually, I had said earlier that I start most of my stories with an idea I want to get across. But in this case, I started with the character of Desiree. And then as I sort of developed her, I began to think of her in more sort of that mythological temptation terms as opposed to a real character. And this story developed out of it. I thought, well, if there is this sort of dark, strange character who is a temptation, what situations should I put her in, and what can I do with that?
So she's the antagonist, and he is somewhat of a protagonist, but very much struggling, so the conflict is all internal. And you do a good job of demonstrating that through the piece. How about if we shift to something lighter, you know?
Sure.
So you went from this struggle, and you used Desiree. Sometimes could be a metaphor, sometimes could be...
And I think the story leaves it unclear whether she even was there.
That's right. And I wondered about that after I read it. Was she there at all?
That was the whole point.
But now, let's come to the modern age, because you wrote a... And by the way, that story was one of the winners in the Elizabeth Simpson Smith short story contest. This next story, I think, this next poem is the one that was published in the Boston Accent Literary Magazine. Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, this is you're bringing us all the way to the present now, because when I was dating, we didn't have this thing called Tinder, right? And this is your what? Give me your title.
Sonnet to Tinder.
Sonnet to Tinder. All right, let's hear Sonnet to Tinder.
O failing app of Aphrodite's curse, its name will tease with hopes and dreams of fire, but leave me only in smoke and tears, alone in dark and cold at night again. A swipe to right results in no response again. I stare at comment screen so bare, my cycloptic picture reveals me now. I stand too fat, too bald, too old, too dull. I try to will my love into the world. I carve her face in stone and text the gods. I wear a bra upon my brow and chant in hopes of swiping her into my life. I kiss the screen and wish for her warm lips, but taste of only the cold, hard screen.
Okay. I like this. A swipe to right results in no response. That's how it works, right?
That is how Tinder works. Okay. Now, swipe. In my defense,
yeah.
I have never been on Tinder myself.
Okay.
In case my wife is listening, I want to make this clear. But I have many a friend who has, and this is sort of where I've learned about this.
I had a friend who was... showing me how it worked, and I actually picked it up and was looking at it, and I pushed the wrong button, which I ended up super liking this person somehow on his. So don't ever let, if you are using this app, don't let me touch it or anyone else that doesn't know what they're doing. I think you left out technologically deficient as well. You got too fat, too bald, too old, too dull. If you don't know how to do the technology, you're also left out of the Tinder world.
I guess that's true as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to move from despair and love to the beach for a moment. This is a piece that you received an award for at UNC Charlotte. I believe it's the James McGarvin Award. You're writing about a sense of place, correct, in this piece?
Correct.
Okay. So we don't have time for you to read the whole piece, but just let's set it up for a minute. You're describing this beach reclamation project at Holden Beach, and you're going to talk about the contrast that exists between the residents who live there, many of whom have lots of money, and their political beliefs, and the reclamation project, which is could be viewed, I suppose, as a subsidy, perhaps. So tell us a little bit about what sparked this idea.
Well, I have a house on Holden Beach.
Okay.
As this piece briefly talks about, before I moved to Holden Beach, I was always sort of shocked and somewhat insulted by the fact that my tax dollars are going to pay for subsidized insurance for beach houses and for beach reclamation projects that don't affect me. And people have these second homes that are being subsidized. And this deeply insulted me until the day I bought a beach house. And then I thought it was the greatest thing ever.
So it's a case of sometimes voting against your self-interest?
Well, now I very much vote in my interest. No, I mean, I still like intellectually I have some questions and issues with it, but there is this dichotomy that I really only thought about once I owned the beach house as well and began to look at both sides of that issue.
But you've got this line in here, maybe you're going to read it, about I own a gun and I vote conservative and that global warming is a fraud, and yet the same people that have their signs out and are making these statements are the ones that are all in favor of the beach reclamation project.
Right.
Give us a couple of paragraphs here.
I will. But you know, and the point of that is that I had the same sort of turnaround in my own head. If it's in my self-interest, you suddenly have a more open mind towards these concepts.
Okay.
So that's why beach subsidy kind of plays off of that.
Give us a few paragraphs from this.
Sure. The deafening roar of diesel engine pumps mingled with the wet crash of tons of seawater, sand, and sediment pouring from a 4-foot-wide flexible pipe. The mouth of the pipe was propped atop a squat metal cart with low, fat wheels that enabled it and the pipe to slowly be rolled as needed. This loud, belching contraption was in stark contrast to its surrounding, the sun-drenched beach of the sleepy resort island of Holden Beach. The Beach Reclamation Project, as such projects are called, was restoring sand to the eroded beachfront of the island. A similar project had been completed 15 years before. Since that time, storms had eroded the sand strip such that at high tide, only a few feet of beach lay between the grassy dunes and the water. Hurricane Matthew, which brushed by in 2016, took a final bite and washed away even those last few feet of open sand, taking much of the dunes with it. And so the reclamation project was accelerated. It had been in the planning stages for years, and the town, working with the federal government and the Army Corps of Engineers, began to pump thousands of tons of sand from the bottom of the nearby Shallotte Inlet onto the beaches of Holden.
All right, let me stop you there, because this is not something that just happened at Holden Beach. I mean, Riceville Beach had this project, other beaches have had it, and then the beaches just come back and take it.
Absolutely.
Nature takes it right back. So yeah. It's almost like you're just pumping dollars into the surf.
And Holden's sort of is just an example of beach towns, right? I am talking about a specific town, but I think every beach town has the exact same issues.
Okay, jump ahead maybe and let's give us a feel for the conflict that exists here.
Sure. The expense, power, and effort needed to manipulate the environment was stunning, costing $28 million in federal, state, and local funding, and the use of vast amounts of equipment. More stunning is knowing that planning was already in the works to do this again sometime in the next 10 to 15 years. As I walked back to my house, a few hundred yards from the beach, I noted anew the faded Trump signs on the sandy lawns and the bumper stickers on oversized Ford and Chevy pickups declaring, "I own a gun and I vote," and conservatism, because not everyone can be a freeloader. And global warming is global fraud. Brunswick County, where Holden Beach sits, has a strong anti-government libertarian bent and is heavily Republican. Over two-thirds of the county voted for Trump and other Republican candidates. Two things are certain among most of the islanders. Government subsidies are a waste of tax dollars, and talk of global warming is as popular as gun control. I wondered how this ideology balanced with the heavily government-subsidized and environmentally dependent place they lived. The subsidies were large, the most obvious being beach reclamation. However, the biggest is hurricane insurance, which is subsidized in, which subsidizes billions of dollars in coastal homes. When I first came to Holden, I was searching for a beach house and met with a realtor named Shannon. She is a well-known figure in Holden, having lived there for decades and sold real estate through thick and thin. We met at a breakfast restaurant called Mermaids, one of only three restaurants on the island. It's a typical beach bar run down with license plates on the rafters and karaoke on Thursday nights. After we sat at our booth and ordered some coffee, we began to discuss the housing market. I asked her about the cost of insurance for homes on the island, given the high risk of damage in storms. Isn't it odd, I asked, that the state subsidizes wealthy people's beach houses? Shouldn't the owners have to bear the cost and risk? She considered me with a look that indicated this is not a popular position to take in a beach town. I pressed on. It's like the beach replenishment projects. Why pay all this money to fight nature so a handful of wealthy homeowners can have their beachfront properties? Shannon shook her head and put down her coffee. These did not seem to be the usual questions she received from potential homeowners. It's not so much about them, the out-of-town homeowners. It's about everybody but them. She patiently explained to me that such subsidies are the lifeblood of coastal towns. Yes, wealthy people often invest in homes here, but most of them then rent to vacationers who come and eat at the restaurants, buy beachware, play putt-putt, load up on groceries, and generally spend a lot of money. This supports the waiters, clerks, business owners, garbage men, and importantly, realtors of the surrounding area. As she finished her coffee, she gave me a matter-of-fact grin. All the spending and subsidies is just good business. After meeting with Sharon, I had a better grasp of why an island of anti-government Republicans would feel so socialist about insurance and beach reclamation. These were their subsidies, and they were good for business.
Okay. You kind of nailed it there. So it's not always clear why people take certain positions. I mean, in this case, it would seem obvious that the people who would put those signs in the yard would be against a project like this until it affects them. And you had some piece in here, you didn't have time to read it, but about how the North Carolina legislature in 2010 actually required the withdrawal of a report because it actually predicted that there would be a rise in sea level on the North Carolina coast in years to come.
Yeah, North Carolina became somewhat infamous that year as it was reported that...
It's hard to believe. Yeah.
It's not hard to believe.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's an example.
Okay, just real quickly, the last paragraph of the piece. You've talked to the realtor, you've talked to a woman who lives there who's very adamantly in support of this. You've talked to her husband, who's a fisherman, who kind of sees that changes are taking place along the coast, but doesn't really want to acknowledge it because he just doesn't. And then you get to the last paragraph.
A few days after my meeting with Shannon, I wandered back to the beach. The reclamation project was finished. The engines and hoses were gone, and a new 30-yard-wide beach glowed in the sunlight. Vacationers bounced in the surf, stretched out on beach towels, or read quietly under umbrellas. Shannon was there, sitting on the beach in her chair, with a beer-filled cooler, talking with some of the other permanent residents of the island. They were talking politics, complaining about Obamacare and the wasteful subsidization of health care.
Thank you for that. That's a great... I can see now why you won the award for that piece. We've just got a little bit of time left, and we're going to do something real quick. Given the conflict out there that exists about monuments and how people approach them differently and how both sides cannot sometimes see where the other side might be coming from, you wrote a piece, I think, that tried to get at the heart of that. It's a poem, right? It's
mm-hmm.
called... What's the title of that?
Babel's Soldier.
All right, let's read that real quick.
The silent soldier stands in the hot sun. For 100 years, a tower of Babel, dividing all. On pedestal above the crowds, bronze continents unmoved, glowing in strife. Below, two crowds shouting in rage at him, at each other. On one side, my family, my past, my future. On the other, my family, my past, my future. Shouts that cross like flames of wrath, unheard, unrecognized, ideas unchanged. Above, he towers, spreading a confusion of language none understand. Below, the crowd splinters further, each to its own belief. On one side, my desires, my fears, my dead. On all sides, my desires, my fears, my dead. In the middle, the bronze man glows from self-consuming fires, heat with no light. My dreams, my anger, my hatred, Metal softens slowly. My, 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 my. The bronze man now twists and melts. But the tower still stands, dividing all.
Now, was this inspired by what's been happening in the last couple of years?
Yeah, it was. And the statue I thought about as I wrote this was Silent Sam. But it doesn't have, you know, it could be any of them.
Silent Sam at UNC Chapel Hill.
Right. But it could be any of them. Really, what I see is when these controversies happen and people are fighting about the statues is that I think of them like the Tower of Babel, which separated the people into different languages. And these have that effect where people are falling into their camps and they're not talking with each other.
They're not understanding
what each other. That's really what these statues begin to represent, is sort of this division within our society.
We've got time for this one last one, because this kind of feeds into that same idea. You've written a piece called Juxtapose, which also is about perhaps one generation not understanding what another generation is thinking, not appreciating necessarily what another generation has been through. And it's a good contrast, so I'd like you to read that as our last piece today.
Sure. Juxtapose. I'm 19. I cringe as my father tells my friends a joke about a bar and a nun. He opens a beer while giving a wide-eyed, extravagant grin that is more suggestive of discovering gold than cheap beer. My friends hide their guffaws during this embellished behavior. I console myself with the knowledge that tomorrow I leave for college. He's 19. He hacks and saws at a banyan tree with his bladed combat knife. The main field is dug out by backhoes, but the edges, too rocky for heavy equipment, are cleared by hand. 200 Army Air Corps beat away at the Philippine jungle, hands bleeding and arms aching to create an airbase in the short hours before a counterattack. At college, I guzzle imported Pilsner and drink shots flecked with tiny specks of gold. I get laughs with stories of my father's sleepwalking. At 1 a.m, I fall into bed with my girlfriend. It is hurried because my roommate will be back soon. At the airbase, it is just after midnight, and he tumbles into a foxhole, dug out by his tiny foldable shovel. Zeros cut his tent mate in half and drop explosives that dig holes and toss bodies in the air. When the planes leave, he unfolds his shovel and moves the bodies and fills the holes so the Mustangs that defend the base can land. At the library, I sequester myself into a corner to cram for midterms. My phone buzzes on the desk like an insistent mosquito. It's my father, calling to again wish me luck or pass on some sage advice. I don't answer. On sentry duty, he squats in the dark by the perimeter wire. In the nearby hills, the sporadic echo of gunfire is punctuated by explosions that vibrate the ground. His hands shake as he checks his rifle. He wants to talk to the corporal a few yards away, but can't. It might draw fire. I'm 21. I cross the crowded stage, tassels swaying in my eyes, to collect a rolled degree from a robed professor. As she shakes my hand, the polite applause is disturbed by the loud hoots of my father. He's 21. He receives his papers, boards a rumbling transport plane, and flies from his besieged base through enemy fire. AK-AK blasts shake his lungs. Shrapnel punctures the heavy body bags that fill the plane's hold, and another image he decides to never discuss. When he lands, he's handed a beer, which he drinks like gold. At home, he greets me at the door, then opens a beer while wearing his extravagant grin. It's years before I understand why.
That is a wonderful piece, Paul. And that last line, I mean, it just kind of sends chills. It's years before I understand why. And isn't it so true that sometimes you don't know what your parents did for you or did before you? But that's a great piece. So what's next?
What's next? Keep cranking.
Keep cranking. All right. Thank you so much for coming to the show today and for these great stories. So that's it for today. Another author giving voice to their written words. Thank you for listening to Charlotte Readers Podcast. If you liked our show, please tell your friends. And if you really liked it, you can help us out by leaving a review on iTunes and by subscribing to the show wherever you listen to it, which you can do for free. Please remember our Season 1 sponsor, Park Road Books. They're right there in Park Road Shopping Center. Drop by the store. You'll be glad you did. And don't forget to check out charlottereaderspodcast.com and the free ebook you can get by signing up for our email list. Speaking of email, my email address is on the website, and I'd love to hear from you. Tell me what you like about the show. Tell me what you'd like to see different. And if you have the name of a Charlotte area author you'd like to hear from, give me the name and I'll follow up. You can like us on Facebook and tweet at us on Twitter. We're going to try to put these shows out on a weekly basis. And next week, we have another talented author coming to read their work. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.